Listener note, the following podcast contains descriptions of murder that some listeners may find upsetting. Some scenes have been dramatized.
The search at Pittodrie was based on information that came in almost 3 weeks after the murder. So the inquiry team decided they would set up at Pittodrie and inspect every mail that came in to see for anybody that had cuts to hands.
It was just something she had in her head that, yeah, he's killed Dodd and he's going to come for me. At night, when she locked that door and she was on her own, that was when she really struggled.
I always, when I went into the front of that car, it was pitch black, I always kind of looked behind me just in case there was somebody in the back seat. And that's just what something like that does to you.
He is highly callous, highly dangerous, someone who does not actually have fear at all, who would be on the police radar.
She would have wanted to see somebody being punished for what they did to Dodd and destroying her life as well. You want justice, not just for Dodd, but for Jessie, for the whole family.
In the previous two episodes, we heard about the night of Thursday, 29th of September, 1983, when local taxi driver George Murdoch picked up a fare in the West End of Aberdeen. On the way to his passenger's destination, for some unknown reason, George pulled into a side street where his assailant took a cheese wire to his throat and strangled him to death. Two 15-year-old boys witnessed the murder, but understandably, they were too traumatised to give a description. A barmaid told the police that on the night of the murder, she had asked a man, too drunk to be served more alcohol, to leave the bar, close to the time when George picked up his killer, which also matched a description given by a witness who saw someone running from the murder scene. From 8,000 witness statements, these were the only two relevant leads, but unfortunately, they came to nothing. Then, 3 weeks after the murder, an assistant at a fish and chip shop a mile from the crime scene came forward and told the police that approximately 15 minutes after the murder, a man came into the shop with several scratches to his face, a bruised eye and a cut hand. Finally, the police had a lead. The Cheese Wire Killer, Episode 3, Jessie. In this episode, we'll hear more about Jessie, George's wife who was made a widow. We'll hear how the murder affected the rest of her life, both in the short and long term. But first, let's look more closely at one of the strongest leads in this investigation. Looking at the newspaper articles from 1983, it's not clear why this witness waited 19 days to come forward with this possibly crucial information. It's difficult to believe that with all of the local media coverage around the time of the murder, that this individual wouldn't have linked what she encountered that night to this murder. The most likely explanation would have been that she was scared. The person who she served that night could have been responsible for a gruesome murder, so it was understandable that she would have been reluctant to come forward. fearing that the killer would come after her, seeking reprisal for her actions. However, on the 18th of October, the fish and chip shop employee did come forward and told the police that about 15 minutes after the murder, a man with several scratches to his face, a bruised eye, and blood dripping from his thumb and first three fingers of his right hand came into the fish and chip shop to order food. The shop was about a mile from the murder scene, and this distance would take approximately 9 or 10 minutes to run. So this sighting does fit the timeline.
Next, please. Next, please. You were on one with the fairies. What can I get you?
Fish and chips, please.
Salt and vinegar?
No.
That's £1.55, please. Spot on, thanks. We're just waiting for the chips to fry. It'll just be a couple of minutes.
Okay.
If you think about the attack that George suffered, how he fought back against his assailant, and that a cheese wire was used, it's completely plausible that these injuries could have been caused by someone who carried out an attack of this kind. Could this person have been George's killer? Detective Inspector James Callender from Police Scotland, the current senior investigating officer on the case, has his doubts.
I don't think any rational person would go and, you know, commit a crime like he's done. Whether that person knew at that moment that he'd killed George, I mean, only he knows. But would you go and buy something in a fish shop? Just, you know, I'm not so sure you would. So, and in any case, that person was never identified. And the people that were in the chip shop at the time, only one or two of them have ever been identified and came forward.
You can understand James's reservations. After all, the idea of walking calmly into a fish and chip shop with cuts and bruises on your face and hands just minutes after viciously attacking someone is impossible to comprehend. But not to the psychologists who I have interviewed for this podcast. Dr. David Holmes is a criminal psychologist who specialises in serious crimes. You'll hear his professional opinion after we hear those of Helen Hart, a chartered forensic psychologist with over 20 years' experience of working with convicted murderers.
Somebody who scored highly in terms of psychopathy wouldn't exhibit the same emotional response to murder or to violence as somebody who wasn't psychopathic. It might just be that actually the murder in itself may have shocked them and angered them, but that when that dissipated, they were then able to think, oh, actually, I'm hungry, I'm going to go and get something to eat. So a psychopath could do that, absolutely. Yeah, I can't imagine that somebody who wasn't psychopathic would be able to do that, because I would imagine somebody who wasn't would have been extremely fearful, not only of what happened and not only in terms of the judgment, the way he was playing it, that, you know, this went wrong, and what that means for him, but also fearful of being apprehended.
If it was him, and obviously there are a lot of people who would say, no, it's ridiculous. If I was in that position, I wouldn't kill somebody and then go into a chippy and order food and expose my injuries. I think that if it was, quite clearly, he's highly callous, highly dangerous, someone who does not actually have fear at all. In his mental remit. So it would be someone who would be a callous criminal, who would be known for other crimes, who would be on the police radar for other reasons. It does seem kind of almost incredible that no one else, no other description, had actually tied in, police description that is, tied in with this chap. Given the fact that he perhaps didn't really care who saw him after the crime, and the fact that someone may mentally record the fact that he's covered in blood shortly after, killing someone by getting his hands covered in blood. It would seem incredulous that the person would not be sensitive or forensically sensitive. And it doesn't really tie in with the idea that no one else has actually really reported very much at all subsequently, on a personal basis or on a, you know, friend basis or a neighbourly basis, that no one has really noticed this chap apart from this lady and the chippy and one or two reports of a running man.
With no other strong lead to investigate, the murder squad took this lead very seriously. On the 22nd of October 1983, just 3 days after this witness came forward, almost 23,000 fans arrived at Pittodrie Stadium, home to Aberdeen Football Club, to watch Aberdeen play Celtic. However, unbeknown to these football fans, once they entered through one of the 44 turnstiles, 75 police officers were waiting to check the hands of every man aged between 16 and 30 years old, hoping they would catch their killer. The police officers took the details of anyone with cuts on their hands.
Hi there, I'm PC Willis from Grampian Police.
Hello, officer.
We're carrying out inquiries today about a murder that happened last month.
Oh, yeah, the taxi driver.
Yes, that's right.
Terrible, that.
Can you show me your hands, please?
Yes, of course.
How did you get these cuts?
I work for a building firm. I'm always getting cuts and scrapes. It's just part of the job.
Is it okay if I take some details from you, please?
Yeah, of course.
Thanks. Can I start by taking your name, please?
Detective Superintendent Jim McLeod, who was leading the investigation, told reporters at the time that he never realised there would be so many people with cuts on their hands. That weekend, the murder inquiry team started to check the details and the alibis of every man with injuries to his hands. However, to the huge disappointment of the murder squad, this ambitious operation revealed no fresh leads.
The police at the time decided, I think it was the Aberdeen Celtic match at Pittodrie, they decided they would check the hands of everybody that came into that game to see if anybody was entering with any hand injuries, and that was obviously didn't produce anything. But it could have been the person, but at the same time, would you go and buy something in a fish shop? Just, you know what rational person would do that?
This must have come as a crushing blow to the team of officers who at the time were working 12 to 16 hour days. But the killer had gone underground. Of course, it's completely possible that the man in the hotel bar and the man in the fish and chip shop were not the same person, nor were either of these men George's killer. And if this was the case, this investigation was now literally like searching for a needle in a haystack. An international haystack. Because of the discovery of oil, Aberdeen was now an international city. In the 1960s, Aberdeen was one of the UK's poorest cities. Once home to the formidable granite, paper manufacturing and shipbuilding industries, and a thriving fishing port, Aberdeen now found itself in a downhill spiral, plummeting into economic decline. Then, in October 1970, the city's fortunes did a complete U-turn when the oil company British Petroleum, now BP, discovered a huge reservoir of crude oil in the North Sea, 110 miles from the Aberdeen coastline. As fast as you could say, we've struck oil, what everyone thought was Aberdeen's guaranteed bleak and grim destiny became exactly the opposite when Aberdeen literally struck gold, black liquid gold, with a string of new oil field discoveries. North Sea oil production grew faster than in any other location in the world. And with its buoyant growth, the population of Aberdeen dramatically increased, rising by over 40,000 people. People came from all four corners of the world. On the streets of Aberdeen, it almost became the norm to hear a howdy as a Texan oil executive tilted his huge Stetson towards you. Oil workers from all over the world flew into the city, riding on its wave of good fortune. Some stayed short term, whilst others would just come and go, in and out of the city, whilst travelling on business. But for the police investigating the murder of George Murdoch, this influx of people caused a significant problem. What if the drunk man or the fish and chip shop customer, both said to have had a local accent, were not the culprit? What if these men, seen by witnesses on the night of the murder, were simply seen in the wrong place at the wrong time? Then the person the police were looking for could have been anyone. They could have come from anywhere, anywhere in the world. So it's fair to say that Grampian Police's needle just got smaller, and their haystack just got bigger, a lot bigger. It's obviously impossible not to feel utter sorrow for what George Murdoch went through that night. Being violently attacked, he must have been scared beyond belief. And of course, losing your life at only 58 years old, with so many years to live. But he was gone, and it was Jessie who would have to live the rest of her life grief-stricken, after losing her beloved husband. She was a nervous woman at the best of times, and the murder of George had catastrophic effects on both her physical and mental health. Here's Alex Mackay, George and Jessie's nephew.
Outwardly, she was still the same Jessie. I mean, I wasn't much to her in the base case. She weighed about 40-odd kilos. So she was very slight. She was very nervous as well, in any event. I mean, if you spoke to her, you wouldn't know, but her health deteriorated drastically. I mean, she had a lot of in and outs of the hospital, etc. Clearly, to do with the killing. She was, and it's not rational, but goodness me, none of us have been in this position, but it's not rational, but she always thought the killer was going to come back after her. I don't think that ever left her. She always felt that that was likely to happen to her, because remember, the killer had his wallet, so had his details, his home, etc. And so to her mind, for some reason, she was going to be next on his list. So even I used to go into my garage at the back of the house. It was dark. And when I went in the car, so it's not rational. I'm saying it wasn't rational for my aunt. It really wasn't rational for me. I always, when I went into the front of that car, it was pitch black because there was no light in the garage. I always kind of looked behind me just in case there was somebody in the back seat. Did that for right throughout that whole winter. Got out of that eventually, but that's just what something like that does to you.
It's more than likely that George's death was a random attack. And if his killer had been picked up by another taxi that night, they instead could have been killed, and George could have safely returned home to Jessie. So the likelihood of the killer making this personal was unlikely. I asked Dr. David Holmes if he thought the killer may have targeted George's wife.
I don't think there was any chance of that. Any particular sort of effort would not really have any consequence. Why would the killer want to do that? Unless there was some kind of grudge, some kind of something hidden, something we don't know about George, his family, and other people, in terms of someone holding a grudge sufficiently, or some inside knowledge sufficiently to want to kill him, and then go on to expose themselves again to leaving evidence to kill his wife for no particular purpose, not even petty cash, I wouldn't imagine. So there was no possibility that that would ever happen.
The theory that this was a random killing was also shared by local taxi drivers throughout the city, so much so that they remained very cautious for quite some time after the murder. Jim Singer was a taxi driver in 1983.
Well, for me personally, and I know a few of the other guys, for a long, long time afterwards, wouldn't have anybody sitting behind us. And a single man on his own wouldn't be sitting, and I'd make him sit in the front. And that went on for quite a while. You know, we were wary. The risks of the job, it just became highlighted for a long, long time. So, yeah, we were all kind of wary of that because you didn't know, you know, if it was going to happen again, or you just didn't know. So, yeah, we were very apprehensive.
Although the killer going after Jesse would have been a very unlikely scenario, with the killer having thought to have stolen George's wallet, which contained ID that included his address. It's understandable. Along with the trauma Jesse had suffered, she would be terrified.
Unless there was evidence that George had been targeted for a particular reason, it wouldn't be likely that he would then want to be going after his family or going after people associated with him. I'm just trying to think of the stranger murders that I've been involved with, and that's just not a feature of any of the ones that I've worked in, because, you know, why would it be? Unless they wanted to target him for a reason, in which case you'd have all of that information already out there. But I suppose, however unlikely it is, that doesn't change the fact that his wife being fearful for the rest of her life is a very rational response for her. So yeah, she probably developed PTSD as a result of what happened to her husband, quite likely, was traumatized for the rest of her life. Maybe the police, maybe somebody did try and reassure her and say, it's very, very unlikely. There's no evidence that this person would do that. It wouldn't stop her being scared that that might happen. That's a really sad way for her to end the rest of her life.
Detective Inspector James Callender from Police Scotland is confident that Jesse would have been reassured that she was safe.
The care of Jesse would have been at the forefront of their mind, that's for sure, and it always is, because, you know, that's what we do as police officers. We're there to detect crime, but first and foremost, we're there to protect the public. So that would have been the one of the main concerns back then, and Jesse was never the same after that. I would imagine passed away herself with a broken heart, I would suggest. But yeah, you know, lived in some fear thereafter, and understandably so.
It's almost impossible not to feel affected by this murder. It highlights the worst possible kind of human nature. But whilst I spoke to George Murdoch's nephew, Alex, he also revealed to me an act at the very opposite end of the spectrum. I just couldn't believe this incredible act of kindness that was shown towards Jesse. George and Jesse's neighbours had a son and daughter. Their son was only 13 years old when George was murdered. George's nephew Alex recalls.
He came home one day and he says to his mum, "Mum," he says, "I've got something I've been thinking very deeply about that I'd like to do for Jesse. What I'd like to do," he says, "is I know how worried that Jesse feels about being herself." He says, "So what I'm like to do is actually go overnight and stay with her overnight until she feels a lot more comfortable being on her own." And they've obviously discussed that as a family. He says, "Well, are you sure you wish to do that?" And he said, "Yes, I'm absolutely sure I wish to do that."
He was 13 years old, just a child. I found this act of kindness completely unbelievable. And I really wanted to speak to this boy about Jesse. I think that it's important that we hear more about Jesse. And this young boy was probably one of the closest people to her after she lost her husband. So let me rewind things here slightly for full disclosure. When I was first told by George's nephew Alex about this boy, he chose, and understandably so, not to share the boy's name with me. He just didn't feel comfortable that this boy, now a man, would have wanted to be identified. After not being in contact with him for almost 40 years, he couldn't have given me his contact details, even if he had wanted to. So Alex, at that point, only referred to him as the boy. In an attempt to find the boy, I searched online for hours, trying to find anything at all about George and Jesse's neighbours, but I found nothing. I then turned to social media. In recent years, various police appeals have sparked online conversations on local Facebook groups about this unsolved murder. And whilst reading through them, something caught my eye. At the bottom of one of the posts, I read the following. "Hope you are well," from David, that lived next door to Dodd and Jesse. I sent him a message introducing myself. I explained that I was producing a podcast about George's murder and asked if he would consider being interviewed. He sent me a message saying that he would like a couple of days to think about it. And because this was a huge thing that him and his family had went through, he also wanted to speak to his parents as a common courtesy. At this point, I didn't even know that he was actually the boy I was looking for. He wasn't necessarily the boy who stayed with Jesse. I also wanted to reassure him about the intentions of this podcast. So I sent him a voice message.
"Hi, David. So I'm putting this podcast together in complete cooperation with Dodd's family. Robina and Alec Mackay are fully supportive of this podcast and they're going to be interviewed as part of it also. The police are also fully cooperating with it. I'm interviewing a member of Police Scotland next week. The aim of the podcast is to try to raise awareness of the case. As a neighbour, it would be great to speak to you. I hope you don't mind me asking, David, but at the time, I believe that one of their neighbours, a young lad of 13, 14 years old, stayed with Jesse for some time, and I'm wondering if that could possibly be you. It would be great to speak to that boy who did that incredible thing for Jesse. Anyway, I'll let you go, David. I'll come back to me whenever you feel comfortable, whenever you've had a chance to speak to your mum and dad and your wife."
Minutes later, he replied, "Appreciate the voice message. To confirm, it was me that stayed with Jesse. I'd found him." For over a week, we exchanged a number of messages. He consulted his family and then he agreed to be interviewed. The boy, now a man in his mid-50s, is called David. We meet at his house and we sit down at his kitchen breakfast bar. His wife Rachel joins us. David has a short and tidy beard and moustache. He's bald and I can tell he's nervous. But he's also such a warm guy. Considering what he did for Jesse, that comes as no surprise. Rachel, his wife, has short, dark hair. She wears glasses and grips onto David's hand supportively throughout the interview. Within minutes of speaking to David, it quickly becomes very obvious just how much George and Jesse meant to him.
George and Jesse, for me growing up, were another set of grandparents. They didn't have family, couldn't have family, so they looked at my mum and dad as kind of like a son and daughter, and me and my sister as grandchildren that they never had. So yeah, it wasn't just like neighbourly, it was family. But yeah, no, he kept himself to himself, hardworking and genuine. Down-to-earth, private, but we'd do anything for you. Jessie was just a beautiful woman, inside and out. And again, we'd do anything for you. Hard-working woman. But yeah, just family to us. Really were amazing people.
At this part of our interview, a phrase pops into my head. You can't choose your family. Well, in David's case, he could and he did. David chose George and Jesse as his grandparents, and they chose him and his sister as their grandchildren. When David speaks about the couple and remembers the good times, his face just lights up. But then sometimes I can see his smile disappear, quickly replaced by a look of sadness as some of the terrible memories come flooding back to him.
I remember the night like it was yesterday. Absolutely horrific. My dad was away on business. I went to bed probably about 9 o'clock. We had school the next day, fell asleep, and then I heard a noise. I was like, what's a noise? And then I realised it was actually howling. It was a howling noise. It was somebody cracking it, and I actually thought it was my mum. I thought maybe her and my dad had an argument on the phone, and I thought, yeah, maybe they've fallen out, and kind of wasn't even dozing back off. But then next thing was my mum came into the bedroom and was like, I need you to sit and look after your sister. I need to go through and sit with Jesse. Something's happened. Dodd's dead. The next thing was downstairs, and mum was through the house. I think at the time there was 2 or 3 policemen in our house. And I'd said to one of the policemen, I don't know what's happened, I don't understand. My mum says, Dodd's been killed. And automatically I'd said, he was a really good driver. I can't believe he's been in an accident, he was a really good driver. And I was just told it wasn't an accident. And that was it. And I was like 13 years old being told by a policeman that, you know, this wasn't an accident. And you don't know what to think. You're just heads all over the place. And I just like sat in the living room kind of in disbelief, and police coming back and forth between Jesse's house and our house and different policemen in and out. Yeah, it was a long night, and all I could hear was Jesse screaming, wailing, coming through from the living room next door. That was all you could hear. Wasn't it just Dodd that died that night? Part of Jesse died that night as a person. Part of her just left. And it was horrible to see. She was convinced that whoever had killed Dodd was going to come for her. It was just something she had in her head that, yeah, he's killed Dodd and he's going to come for me. I think because Jessie lived in the end house as well. She lived in the gable end, and there was like a big bit of park land before it, and then a little lane. And she just used to think somebody was going to, he was going to come in over the fence and break into the house during the night. She just had that in her head that was what was going to happen. She would do what she had to do to get through the day, and I think it was just at night when she locked that door and she was on her own, that was when she really struggled and would just break down.
Mum?
Yes, darling?
Jessie, she must be really lonely now.
Well, yeah, she will be. She's missing George, and she's never lived by herself, and she's scared that whoever did that to George, that he'll come back for her. But they won't, David.
I know, Mum. Is it okay with you if I stay with her? You know, overnight in the spare room, just for a while. Just so she feels safer.
Oh, David, that's such a nice thing to offer. Yes, I think Jessie would like that. I think she'd like that very much indeed. Are you sure, though?
Yes, I am, Mum. I want to do it.
Oh, you're such a kind and thoughtful boy, David. Come here.
Get off. You'll mess up my hair.
They then went next door and explained to Jesse what David had suggested and how they supported him in doing that. And of course, she was over the moon that would happen. He would do all his homework, he'd do all these things that he needs to do, watch television and go through about, say, 9:30, 10 o'clock at night. He started off doing that, and it continued for, amazingly, it continued for 2.5 years. That really helped her, a crucial part of her grieving process, her recovery, whatever you wish to call it. She felt safe with somebody being in the house with her. Again, as I mentioned, always thinking this guy might come back, just having another person in there, so could raise the alarm or what have you. So, I mean, it really helped her. Probably for the first time in the longest time, she was able to sleep reasonably well at night. That really helped heal a lot of the open wounds. I can't think of anything high enough to say about David and doing something like that. God bless him. Really, God bless her.
Just in case you thought you may have misheard what Alex just said. Yes, you heard correctly. David stayed with Jesse, never missing a night for almost 2.5 years.
I still had my life with my pals and everything like that. They didn't know what I was doing. Because I would just say to them, yeah, I've got to be in by 9 o'clock. And I would go in through the front door, get out the back door, and she would have a tea and a biscuits all sitting ready for me every night at 9 o'clock. We would just sit and chat, watch telly, whatever, and yeah, Jesse would go to her bed, I would go to my bed.
Jesse, are you still awake?
Yes, David, I'm awake.
Do you believe in heaven?
Yes, I do. Why?
Do you think George is in heaven?
Yeah, I do, David. Dodd was a good man, so yes, I do think he'll be in heaven. Why do you ask?
I don't know. I suppose I just like to imagine George happy and smiling in heaven.
Me too, David. Me too. Now, go to sleep or you'll be falling asleep at school tomorrow.
Okay. Night-night, Jesse.
Night-night, David.
Some nights were horrific when she was just basically screaming, sobbing her heart out. Just nights that she was so, so bad, just with panic and just upset. And Dodd was her life. He was her world. And she's never ever came to terms with what happened. Didn't think anything about it. It was just like, it's what you do. There would be nights like you'd hear her crying, and like knock on her door and go in and just give her a hug. Just give her a hug until she fell asleep. It might sound strange, like a 13-year-old doing that, but...
She's like your grandmother.
Yeah, she was.
Sensing that David may have just felt slightly uncomfortable telling me that as a 13-year-old boy, he would climb into bed and hug Jesse, David's wife Rachel offers a supportive observation. She was slightly off mic, so you may not have been able to hear her clearly enough just then, but Rachel said she was like your grandmother. Hearing David tell me this in his own words, even without Rachel's observation, I feel anything but uncomfortable. I just feel in total awe of the love and support this 13-year-old boy offered Jesse.
There was a couple of nights where I had to go downstairs and phone mum and dad, even though they were next door, or just bang on the wall, and they knew if it was something, but it was the one that I had to phone them and say, look, I don't know what I'm doing, I can't handle it. And she was inconsolable that night. Just for love and respect that you had for them, that's what made you do it. I think the first year was the hardest. I didn't even really look at it like a time scale when I look back on it. I just think, yeah, I did that from my 13th birthday to my 16th birthday. And at 13 years old, you're not looking to see how she's progressing. I just wanted her to be, you're okay when I'm here. I want to make sure you're okay. It's hard to describe, but she wasn't the same Jessie as before that night. That night, part of Jessie died as well. Confidence, her health, just everything from then went downhill. You'd see a smile on her face, and obviously you're trying to speak about good times and things like that, but it took her a while. Yeah, it did take her a while, but she never, ever, ever got over what happened. And for me, the worst thing is Jesse's gone to her grave not knowing, not seeing justice. And that's all you ever want. Every year, I think, on the anniversary, this is another year we don't know. Somebody knows, but we don't know, but somebody else does. Yeah, just wanted, I don't know, just for any remaining family members and for Jesse's memory that Dodd gets justice.
So, this is where it happened. Yes, Jesse, I think it is. Are you sure you want to do this?
No, I'm not, but it feels like something that I have to do. Because this is where George...
That's a beautiful rose.
Aye, George liked roses. I won't be long.
Take all the time you need, Jesse.
Thank you, Helen. You're a good friend. Hi, George. Oh, George, what am I going to do without you? I keep on imagining that you're going to walk in through her front door, but I know you're not. I love you, George, and I miss you. I miss you so much. Can you take me home, please, Helen?
Yes, of course.
It wouldn't have made it easier for her, I think, if she had to go through a trial or anything. I don't know how she would have coped with that. But yeah, I think she would have wanted to see somebody being punished for what they did to Dodd and destroying her life as well. Yeah, just you want justice, not just for Dodd but for Jesse, for the whole family. Sorry. Somebody knows who did it. How you can defend somebody that's taken somebody's life, I'll never ever know. Never know that. A good man, a good couple that didn't deserve what happened to them.
When I left David and Rachel's home that day, I sat in my car for a few minutes, taking in what I had just heard. David loved George and Jesse. That was very apparent. And I don't think he's ever fully processed and dealt with the trauma of losing George. Once the interview was over, and as I was leaving their home, David told me that he had agreed to do the interview for a couple of reasons. He hoped by speaking about it, it may just help him come to terms with what happened, and he would do anything that would possibly help the police get the lead that once and for all would finally bring George's killer to justice. David may never get over George's murder, but I do think that one day George's killer will have to answer for the appalling crime that he committed on the 29th of September 1983. Coming up in episode 4 of Who is the Cheesewire Killer?
It's a term used in parapsychology, psychical research, to refer to acquisition of information about the future by seemingly paranormal means.
The Crime Watch side of things was really to get it national, because Aberdeen is such a multinational city, because we know the cheese wire was manufactured in a company down south.
If that person was a psychopath, then it's quite possible that they wanted to kind of hang around and watch and see kind of how that investigation was then unfolding.
There is still a couple of inquiries that we're needing to carry out, but at the moment we haven't identified who the wearer of the Iron Maiden t-shirt was.
And it's always been in my mind for over 40 years. I feel that I could have found the guy responsible and didn't, and wasn't afforded the opportunity to do that.
If you have any information about what may have happened to George Murdoch on the night of 29th September 1983, please do get in touch. A £50,000 reward remains for any information that successfully leads to the identity of the killer. You can private message the George Murdoch Facebook page. Search for Appeal for information, Aberdeen Taxi Driver, 1983, George Murdoch on Facebook. You can email jdhallfield@mail.co.uk, or you can call Police Scotland on 101, all of which you can do anonymously. Also, please rate, share, and tell people about this podcast. The more people who hear this story, the better chance we have of finally bringing George Murdoch's killer to justice. You've been listening to Who is the Cheesewire Killer? Written, produced, edited, and presented by me, Ryan Ogilvie. Mixed by Christopher McDonald. Dramatic scenes were produced by Leanne Colston, Rory O'Shea, and Steve Henderson. Actors included Angela Duguid, Ben Barclay, Daniel Warren, Guillaume Potter, Jenny Dunbar, Kenny Blythe, Kenny Luke, Martin Barclay Bell, Oliver Johnston, and Steve Henderson. Music from New Noise Audio and Soundstripe. Studio facilities were provided by Original 106. This is a Mind the Gap creative production.